From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio, and we're talking with Lewis Coleman today. He's the environmental planner for the city of La Crosse, which has just adopted, a little while back, has adopted a new climate action plan, which we're going to hear about. And then we're going to hear about an opportunity coming up next week for small businesses and organizations to come together and learn about making a sustainability plan for their own organizations. But first, before I delay any more, Lewis, welcome back to Newsmakers. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So the climate action plan, you guys spent a long time working on this. When did your work on this start?
Oh my gosh, good question. Well, I'll go back to 2009 with our strategic plan for sustainability that the city did with the county. And typically we try to update plans every 10 years. So we were looking at funding back in 2019, looking for grants. Fortunately, there was some Xcel Energy credits that we were able to sequester and use for this planning process. So we actually started late in 2021, and then did the planning process in earnest through 2022, and then adopted the plan in January of 2023. So it's just about a year old.
So talking about it in pretty broad strokes, what does the plan encompass that people might find interesting to know about how their city operates?
Sure. One of the things we're looking at specifically is a way to measure our impact. I think a lot of topics we were trying to address in our sustainability plan from 2009 had a lot of different ways to measure things. And we're looking from this plan specifically on carbon or, greenhouse gas equivalent. So we're using kind of a standard formula that's consistent across municipalities, other government organizations, other like businesses and organizations use a standard protocol. So it's kind of a way to compare apples to apples. So that's kind of one of the biggest changes. And then we looked at the plan through 9 different sections. We have transportation and mobility, buildings and energy, housing and land use, waste management, water and stormwater, food and health, the economy. I'm running low on things, but it's a lot of stuff. About 9 different sections, and then each section has roughly about 5 strategies, and then each strategy has a lot of actions. So the overall there's about 300 actions, which is I have to remind myself it's a buffet, not you have to eat everything.
Yeah, it's hard to implement. It looks like a lot when you read it on paper,
yeah.
But it's less possible to implement something if it's not broken down into small steps, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So looking at it that way and trying to figure out those small steps that we can take and different options that we can look at, sometimes issues that might have looked possible either financially or politically at one time might not be, or that it might change. So the winds change, and we need to be adaptable to that. So, yeah.
So when you started collecting these ideas for this plan, you talked about a previous plan that you worked with through mm-hmm. the county. Did you have an opportunity to see what either other counties and municipalities in our area or models that you were able to look at from the rest of the country and look as kind of a guidepost and
sure.
figure out your path forward?
Well, typically what we do is try to look at communities that are in our area. So, cold weather climates, that kind of is a big issue to focus on. And then we also look at, potential river cities or college towns, cities that are about our size. And then also we look at communities in Wisconsin specifically because of the state legislative environment, like what are communities allowed to do? I mean, some communities might be allowed to do something different in Minnesota or Illinois, but in Wisconsin we can't do it. So that's kind of what we look at. I think we like to look at Eau Claire as a comparison community. They do a lot of good work. I'm friends with the planner there, and so one of the nice things about working in government is that the documents are public domain. So if you need something, you can easily borrow it and adapt it to your own needs. So yeah, I mean, we looked at a lot of different communities. We also, what we do is, since we don't have the staff necessarily to do a plan ourselves, is we work with consultants, and these consultants have, you know, experience with a lot of different communities too. So that was one of the starting points for the plan, is that our consulting firm had a massive spreadsheet of all these different policies from communities across the Midwest that they had worked with. So yeah, those examples were really helpful.
So of all of the, you talked about the 9 main subject areas, and then mm-hmm. all of the strategies under those areas and the specific tasks under that, you know, 200 or 300 things of all of that, are there one or two specific things that as the list was coming together, you look at that and go, oh, this is a great idea, and this is something that is an accessible idea that we can do right now?
I would say that when we're looking at these things, we're looking at, like, are there good partners to work with? And fortunately, organizations like Xcel Energy have similar goals. They're also looking at being carbon neutral by 2050. So they have programs to reach that, to help homeowners and businesses. So those things are definitely what we're looking at. So that's going to make it easier for mm-hmm. us. I mean, I guess I'm more looking at what's going to be the biggest challenges. And I think one of the biggest challenges we're going to be facing is the electrification of our transportation. So getting our
buses.
When
you say electrification of transportation, are you talking about the transportation which is under the direct control of the city, or are you talking about, like, encouraging residents and businesses to also do that?
We're talking about both. So not only getting electric vehicles for the city, but also making it easier for members of the community to get electric vehicles. I know a lot of concern is, like, where are we going to charge? So I think, you know, making sure that our regulations are up to snuff when it comes to enabling EVs, like when somebody wants to install a charger, we know how to handle it. And then also, you know, investing in that. So that's kind of the biggest thing, is just making sure that we've got our, you know, regulations in place.
Before we started recording our conversation, you were talking about, like, some of the little things that, like, people can start making more environmentally sound decisions regarding things like recycling in their workplace or whatever, just by taking steps to make it the path of least resistance. So, like, what are there one or two things that somebody listening to this conversation, you know, might be able to implement in either in their home or in their workplace?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I was sharing my sort of mantra of making the sustainable choice the easiest choice. So, like, if you've got a trash can, put a recycling bin right next to it so it's easy to recycle. That's one thing. An easy thing, too, is changing your lights from, incandescent or even compact fluorescent to LEDs. That has one of the quickest return on investments. Thinking about how you're getting to work or getting from place to place. It's winter. I biked here. I don't think that's accessible.
In the middle of the snow.
Yeah.
You literally biked here. It is actually snowing outside.
So, I mean, and that's not for everybody, of course.
Yeah.
But in the summer, like, you know, May is National Bike Month. So that's a good opportunity to get around. And then I think one of the biggest things too is it's important to make personal changes, but we really need to be working together. So if you're going to do something, try to convince someone else in your family to join you, or someone in your community, or, you know, your neighbor or your coworker, that so we need more people to do it. It's not just you've done your part and then that's it. It's got to be a real collective effort.
So a lot of people listen to suggestions, and if they either are unsure of part of it or they can't do it perfectly, they don't do it at all, right? And so you talked about the light bulb thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you talking about like people should go through and immediately replace every light bulb in their house, or are you talking about like a progressive thing? As this light bulb burns out, replace it with an LED bulb.
That's one way to go about it. I think you don't necessarily need to wait until it burns out. One of the things that I'm doing, like I have some CFLs in my apartment right now, but I'm kind of waiting for some LEDs to go on sale. So I mean,
okay.
wait for a discount if that's something you wanna wait on, and you know, tackle one room at a time. You don't have to do everything all at once. It's just, you know, look for opportunities, make a note of it, and then make that change, and then take the next step, and then the next step.
So when you're talking about getting the city to look at a new way, you know, this, we talk about the city as kind of a monolith, but it's not at all. All these different buildings all across town with where the different departments are located, they have people that have been there a short time, a long time, people who generationally might be more inclined to think about these kinds of things, or maybe a little bit more like, I just, you know, just leave me alone and let me do my job. And so what's the challenge in getting buy-in from your colleagues on a plan like this?
Yeah. Fortunately, we've gotten a lot of support within the city and from our elected officials, so that's been really great. I think at the same time, there's a limitation with the capacity that we have. I mean, you know, there's some, we need funding, of course, to tackle these changes. So if we want to spend money on this, we have to sacrifice somewhere else. So we have to think about how can we do this efficiently? How can we take advantage of grants that are available? I'm really closely following the bipartisan infrastructure law incentives and the Inflation Reduction Act incentives. And those are, of course, incentives that homeowners and business owners can take advantage of as well. I mean, they're complex, and that's what hopefully the city can help people with. But I need to do that within the municipality as well. So really making it easier for people within the city to take advantage of these programs, and yeah.
So I remember one time when we talked, you were part of a conversation that we were having about the use of salt during the winter, and that's the thing. As we speak, there are, you know, trucks running around the city putting salt on the roads, and yeah, I mean, I'm not a don't ever use salt on the roads kind of person. I don't know enough to say whether that's an appropriate thing or not. I'm not mad about it, but it just it's an interesting juxtaposition, because somebody in your position, as an environmental planner looking at it through that lens, may be more inclined to say, we need to immediately work to find every way to reduce the use of salt on these roads. And somebody from the public safety perspective or from that part of the city might say, hey, I need to find the most cost-effective way to make sure people don't run into each other and, you know, load the truck up and get it out there. So how do you begin conversations like that on these big, you know, major issues where there's a way of doing things and you're trying to introduce a different part of that thought process that people might be less inclined to immediately consider?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think with salt, there are a few different considerations. I mean, you don't want to overuse it, because then that's inefficient and you're wasting money. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the main things we talk about in terms of either even sustainability, is just like, you don't necessarily need to overdo things, but we're trying to save you money. And then also, salt isn't effective below a certain temperature. So if you're trying to get more traction, you need to apply sand. Fortunately, our street department is very well educated on salt use. We have been, we have a brine truck. So that's a mixture of salt and water. So mm-hmm. you're using less salt, and they'll apply it before it snows to prevent icing up. So that's one way we're reducing our salt use. I think as someone who walks and bikes around, I see a lot of salt on sidewalks, and that can be, you know, that's definitely going to make a salt line on your shoes. And mm-hmm. Salt is corrosive. It's not just, it doesn't just melt water. It's corrosive to sidewalks. When you see grass in the spring and there's just like a dead zone right next to the sidewalk, it's typically because it's the salt that runs off and you're basically salting the earth. I've seen firsthand, like, there's steps at my apartment and there's a metal railing and the steps were salted, but the salt like would corrode the metal. So the railing actually came loose. So you had to repair that. So
wow.
Salt is very corrosive.
Yeah.
So overusing it isn't a good idea.
Not to mention, a lot of people have pets and it can be really bad on, you know, you walk the dogs. I've got dogs in my house. We walk the dogs and they get this stuff all over their feet. And not only does it track all over the house or whatever, but then they try to clean themselves and, you know, them ingesting that isn't very good. And then the corrosive effect, it dries out their paws. It can be really damaging and lead to all kinds of things.
Right. And that's a good point. I mean, there are some indirect, you know, things that happen because of our less sustainable practices, and fortunately through using more sustainable practices there can be indirect benefits. So one of the maybe sort of easy practices that people can do is collect their food scraps and use it as composting. So you've got the direct benefit of reducing the amount you're taking to the curb, so potentially may save money on waste removal, but that compost can be used on your garden in your backyard. So you're amending your soil. So that's sort of an indirect benefit of a good practice.
Yeah. Well, speaking of education on environmental issues, there's an upcoming event that I want to talk about in just a moment. We heard from Tom Schlesinger a month or so ago about a plan that small businesses and other organizations can use to help develop environmentally friendly practices within their own organizations. And there's an opportunity for people to participate in a workshop, getting some education about that. We're going to talk about that coming up. In the meantime, if you would like to get in touch with our show about this issue or anything at all, you can always email me. Our email address is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. We'll be back in a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We're continuing our conversation with Lewis Coleman. He's the environmental planner for the City of La Crosse. We've been talking, Lewis, about the city's climate action plan. And as part of that plan, you're working with, among others, the Climate Alliance for the Common Good, whom we've had on this show before. And they've released a sustainability toolkit for small businesses and organizations. And there is a workshop related to that toolkit that you all are hosting together. Tell me, it's coming up next Thursday the 18th from noon to 3. Talk about that event.
The event is a partnership with the city and the Climate Alliance for the Common Good to help small businesses develop sustainability plans. There's a number of steps that work through the toolkit. I mean, a business could take on the toolkit themselves, but it's always nice to have someone walk you through it. And I think we're seeing that too. Like when I was talking earlier about working within the city, within the municipality, and helping my colleagues, anytime you can walk someone through a process and, you know, basically hold their hand through the process is really helpful and is necessary. I don't always have the time for it, which is why we're doing this workshop. So it's a collaborative effort. We've got a number of different speakers from different organizations talking about the kind of work they do, the kind of incentives that are available, what a business or organization can expect when, you know, installing solar panels or heat pumps or, you know, composting their food waste. And then we're going to hopefully at the end, you know, bring it all together and help people come up with the initial steps that they can take and bring back to their business.
Well, some people are good at taking, and you can download this toolkit from the Climate Alliance's website and just look at it and read it and see what is implementable in your own organization. And some people, that's all they need and all they want. But some people are really going to thrive in an environment where they can brainstorm and where they can, you know, get it. I can sit down and get an idea from Lewis that I never would have had on my own. And yet it's a great idea that I can use, and vice versa. I might say something that somebody else can use. What's the registration requirement for this?
It's free. It's just a sign up on the Eventbrite page and you'll get the information and we'll be in touch. And then as you were mentioning too, it's nice to, you know, find like-minded businesses. So as you're, you know, working through your process in the future, you might find that like, well, maybe I should reach out to this person, or for sure reach out to me or the Climate Alliance for the Common Good, and we'll be able to help you out. I mean, that's what we're there for. The recommendations in the toolkit align really closely, if not like are verbatim in the city's climate action plan. So me helping businesses is part of my work.
So if people are interested in finding that Eventbrite link that you mentioned, I did a quick Google search, and it's on the Climate Alliance's website, and there's a button right on the top of their website that says upcoming toolkit workshop, and you can click on that and find it. Is there somewhere else that people should be looking to find that link?
Yep. There's a Facebook event for the event. Or you can go straight to Eventbrite. We'll likely have a blog post on the city posted really soon.
Okay.
That has more information about it.
Good. So what are some of the topics that are going to be covered at the sustainability workshop?
So the topics we're looking at are around, like, say, your building. So how are we increasing the energy efficiency in your building? And how can we add renewable energy to your building? Some business owners don't own their building. They're renters. And we'll look at other ways that we can help them out, or how we can, you know, engage in a conversation with their landlord. Likewise, we're looking at how we can save money outside of the building through stormwater credits and, you know, absorbing the runoff and reducing waste. Typically looking at like food, like composting and recycling. And then also some small businesses, maybe not many, have fleets. So like I was mentioning earlier, how we can help convert to electric vehicles. And and then lastly, really hitting hard on incentives. So I think, you know, people might be looking at some of the recommendations in the toolkit and thinking like, that sounds great, but I don't have the money to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, typically there's a lot of money out there, and it's just a matter of connecting with, you know, those resources. Like, okay, there's a tax incentive here, so we'll get a rebate on our tax bill. Or there's Focus on Energy or Xcel Energy have incentives for increasing energy efficiency and renewable energy. The city has a stormwater credit, so by reducing the amount of stormwater that runs off your property, you can get a credit there. So there's a lot of opportunities, and it's just a matter of connecting people with those.
And that goes, the financial incentives one, it seems like that goes right in line with what you were talking about earlier about making the environmentally conscious choice the easy choice.
Right.
And the one that makes the most fiscal sense, because a lot of people as business owners, they're like, oh, that's nice, but my first priority is to stay in business.
Exactly.
And that means watching the bottom line.
Yeah, so What we're trying to do is, you know, make sure that we're reducing the upfront cost. Over the long term, these are processes that are going to save money. So that's the goal. However, the upfront cost is probably the major concern. So anything we can do to alleviate that is what we're looking at.
So the workshop that's coming up this Thursday, where is it and how much room is there?
Sure. Yeah, the workshop's going to be at the La Crosse Center in the South Ballroom A, and we're capping the participation at 25. We want to make sure we have a good, robust conversation. That being said, we don't want to exclude anybody. So, you know, I will be available to talk to businesses outside of the workshop. Mm-hmm. Tom from the Climate Alliance will be able to talk to businesses outside of the workshop. Also, we're looking at hosting more workshops in the future. So we'll review our process this time and, you know, refine it and get more coordinated workshops in the future. So if you can't get in, that's okay. We'll still talk to you and help you out as best we can.
So if people are either because of registration limitations or maybe their own scheduling issues not able to attend, they could reach out to you through the city's website or to Tom through the Climate Alliance's website and begin a relationship anyway.
Exactly. Yep.
So you have this event that's this coming Thursday from noon to 3, and people can find information about that on the Climate Alliance's website or by going to Eventbrite and looking for I guess if they just search for events coming up in La Crosse, it'll show up. Okay. And but as far as implementation of the plan that you have been working on with the city, the environmental plan, the climate action plan, as that moves through, is there something that you're particularly excited about over the next year or two that makes you go, okay, I can't wait to dig into this?
Building electrification is a big deal. We've gotten some money from the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant, which is a program that, you know, came out over a decade ago, and then now there's another round of money. So our community gets a definite amount, and it's just a matter of like how we use it. So that's great. I'm really looking forward to our forestry staff are working on a urban forestry plan. So that's really exciting to see like how we're increasing trees and you know, increasing shade and cooling our urban environment. Also, we're continuing our performance contract with Johnson Controls. So we are adding solar panels to Fire Station 2 and 4, and then also, you know, adding some energy efficiency equipment to our pools. So those are pretty exciting projects that we've got coming up. Oh, and then adding more solar panels to the La Crosse Center. So that's really exciting after the really cool renovation that's happened at the La Crosse Center to now increase its renewable energy generation. It already has 100 kilowatt array. We're going to add another 200 to it. So it's really, really big deal.
That's I don't know how to determine like how much energy that is, like compared to what it takes to run a facility like that. How much energy are those when that project is completed? How much of the facility's energy needs will be met by that those arrays?
You know what, the sun varies, so the amount of energy varies. I guess at the peak, you know, of the summer, at the peak of the day, of a hot day, we should get about 100% or close to 100%. So like
that's impressive.
So like at 1 o'clock, we'll get like 100% of the energy for the building.
Yeah. Well,
but
that's,
you know,
nice.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. That's significant.
Yeah.
Good. Lewis Coleman is the environmental planner for the city of La Crosse. And we've been talking about all kinds of interesting things, climate action plan, the upcoming sustainability workshop. Lewis, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this conversation again, or if you'd like to check out a previous episode of our show, you can find them all on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. The Artaria String Quartet is back in La Crosse this weekend, and we're going to talk to a couple of them about their longtime La Crosse connections and an interesting new project on which they are in the middle, where they're playing all of the string quartets by a particular composer. You're going to find out all about it next here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. Thanks very much for joining us today. We have some longtime La Crosse-connected musicians based out of the Twin Cities, the Artaria String Quartet, and they're in the midst of a really, really interesting project, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk to them about it. We have precisely half of the quartet here. We have Ray Shows and Nancy Oliveros, who are joining us today, the violinist. We're leaving the viola and the cello behind for today, and I hope that they will forgive us. Ray, Nancy, welcome to Newsmakers.
Glad to be here.
Nice to be here, Ezra.
So for people who are not familiar, the Artaria String Quartet has a long history of performing in the La Crosse area. Why don't you, Ray, let's start with you. Give us sort of the brief sort of thumbnail sketch of Artaria's professional association with La Crosse.
Well, first of all, I would probably defer to Nancy since she is the La Crosseite, but you can edit that comment out if you like. Artaria, because of Nancy's connections with the music department at Viterbo University many, many years ago, around 1992, I think if I'm getting the correct year, we invited Artaria to come and spend some time performing and working with the string students and the choirs while we were on a residency with the National Endowment for the Arts in Tifton, Georgia, of all places. And we made La Crosse made a good impression on the other one. And we decided it would be a nice place to have a permanent residency, and it happened.
Yeah, Nancy, this is home for you. La Crosse is your hometown.
Yeah, it is. I was born and raised in La Crosse, and had the benefit of a beautiful community and excellent education system in place, and lots of friends. And went away for a while and found Ray. I had to go out in the world to find him.
And ran into me.
And rescue him from whatever he was doing then.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And I had to, anyway, he kind of corralled me, I think, though. And we ended up in Boston for almost 10 years together at Boston University. And then we stayed there. We had our kids in Boston, our wonderful sons. And I loved it there. I absolutely loved our life in Boston. It was rather hectic. And then when the NEA offered us this residency in rural Georgia, you know, we took it and got our small youngins down there. And then the connection surfaced with Viterbo University in La Crosse. And my whole quartet absolutely really loved it and really wanted to be there. And so I said, okay, I'm going home. And I was so glad to do that. Made lots of new friends and was able to be with my parents and siblings and all that sort of thing. So it was really great.
Now, fast forward all these many years, and you're doing something very interesting with the string quartets of Béla Bartók, which you've done with other composers as well, and that is playing the whole cycle, as Ray said earlier, all of the string quartets of Béla Bartók. So, mm-hmm. So Ray, where does Béla Bartók rank in the pantheon of string quartet composers?
Wow, depending on what particular rubric we're using, Bartók lands on the top of almost all of them in terms of his musical curiosity, musical intensity, unique creativity, rhythmic, that's the word I'm about, rhythmic strength and vitality, harmonic interest and coloration, which he created, developing it through the Romantic composers, but always reaching back, like all the composers worth their salt, back to Beethoven. And literally right out of the Große Fugue, you can hear in many of the Bartok quartets, the complexity of that, what we refer to as a gentleman and gentlewoman's sword fight. And you can hear all of that inside of these tremendous string quartets, six of them. Now, Beethoven wrote 16 quartets, and Shostakovich, another great 20th century string quartet writer as well, wrote 15. But Bartok's six quartets are a cornerstone of the 20th century in terms of music. And they are 30 years in development from 1909 to 1939. And we had the, and of course, Nancy should also talk about this, but we had the privilege of studying them with a gentleman in the Kolish Quartet who they were written for. The last two or three were written for them, quartets number five and six, and I think they also premiered number four. But we studied the fifth and sixth quartet with the horse himself, having played and been one of the proteges of Bartok. His name is Jano or Eugene Lehner, and he and his Hungarian colleagues were very young when they were early 20s, when they were playing this music and play, it's just to be able to study with that kind of connective information is, like I said, it's a privilege.
What is that like? To we hear people all the time connecting their literal family trees in various ways. What's that like to know that your musical family tree, Nancy, extends through this very direct connection right back to the composer?
There's nothing like it, actually. We felt and still feel like we're Bartok's grand students. We studied with Eugene Lehner in Boston. And at the time that we were studying with him, we studied at his home each week for many years, actually. Even after we had our children, he was still hearing us and advising us and mentoring us. And I remember sitting on his couch in the living room one day, and that's when we were studying the sixth quartet. And the sixth quartet opens with a soliloquy by the viola. And we were talking about that, and he was such a kind and gentle man. And he quietly told me that Bartok had been sitting right where I was sitting when they first discussed it.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I just loved that. You really, there's something spiritual about that. It's really wonderful.
That is quite a connection. That's just amazing. So, so you're doing a series of performances, not only in the Twin Cities area where you're based now, but you're also on consecutive weekends doing these performances on Sunday afternoons at Viterbo University in the Fine Arts Center recital hall. And last week, people have already missed the second quartet and the fifth because they were performed last week. But you've got two more coming up. What can people look forward to this coming Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock and then the next Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock? Ray, do you want to take that one?
We, as you mentioned, we did quartets two and five, probably the most challenging program, actually, of the three for us. And but it went fantastically all week long. And this week we have quartets number three and number one on the plate and or on the in the hall, as it were. And the third quartet is probably the most far afield harmonically of any of the six quartets. It's not atonal, but it's harmonically very, very much pulled like taffy from Tonic. And then after the third quartet, which is a mere 14 or 15 minutes long, we proceed to the first quartet that he wrote as quite a young man in 1909. He was in his, I think he was 24 years old or something like that. And it's, but it's very much French influenced. You're going to hear a lot of Debussy and Ravel overtones literally throughout the piece. It's lovely for Nancy and I because we open the concert with, I mean, we open the piece, number one, with a beautiful duet. And in the third week that we return to La Crosse, we will close out the Bartók cycle with quartets number four and number six. Let me get the right order. Nancy, you tell them a little bit about that concert, number six and number four?
We'll start with number six, his last quartet. I think it's his most beautiful quartet as well. I think one and six are just, he starts it so beautifully and he ends the cycle 30 years later, kind of in the same beautiful setting down of everything. But number four is the arc of the six. It's rather the peak of really finally realizing his harmonic language and expression. It's a very expressive piece. You know, Bartók, I just want to mention quickly, is that he investigated folk music before he wrote any of these, and especially by the time we're going to get to number four and number five and number six. The folk music of Eastern Europe and Northern Africa provides enough for him to have a fascinating harmonic language.
So whereas some of us go off to, you know, university and graduate school and postdoctoral programs and are influenced by all of that, Bartók goes out among sort of real people and takes their traditions and incorporates it back into and helps elevate it by bringing it into this really beautiful space.
Absolutely. And the way he felt and the way, after experiencing all six of these quartets in depth, you realize that it's that that elevates the classical music.
Ezra, I quoted him in our program notes. This is Béla Viktor Janos Bartók speaking about just the thing, the theme that Nancy's talking about folk music. Bartók says, "Folk melodies are the embodiment of an artistic perfection of the highest order."
I want to talk about some of the other work that you're involved in, because the literature that people would most often associate with string quartets, in addition to Bartók, you know, you hear about Beethoven, you hear about Mozart and Haydn and others, but you are involved in Ray, what you described to me as mission-centric performances. Talk about some of the work that you've been doing the last few years.
Well, all of us have through the pandemic have had to reevaluate our lives. Our priorities may not have changed that much, but in the context of Artaria, COVID, and also with the incident of George Floyd's murder in 2020, literally three blocks from where we rehearse in Minneapolis during the COVID time. If COVID hadn't happened, we wouldn't have been in that space at that time when that incident and event struck the world so firmly. And so we sat down and reevaluated what it was to be a musician in this dark time. We decided to play at every single performance a composition from a person of color or a female composer, people that were underserved compositional pieces and repertoire. And for the next 17 or 18 months, we were streaming our concerts, and month after month, we're locating new works. And now that we're back to a more normal concert organizational time frame from one to the next, we have continued putting on composers, like, as I mentioned, composers of color, composers that are underperformed, underserved, and with the exception of the Bartók cycle, every single performance and every single concert has a repertoire that represents represents those entities.
So what kind of educational experience has that been for you to even maybe learn about music that you didn't know about?
Oh, my goodness. We were missing out. It has broadened our awareness of all kinds of composers, living and past composers who are fascinating, interesting, and have contributed greatly to the string quartet genre that, you know, just fill out more of who we are as musicians, contribute to the palette of what we do. We're so happy that we've broadened ourselves more.
Oh, and it's attracted a base of younger players that are not throwing you know Beethoven and composers like him aside, but they are very much attracted to compositions that were written currently by living composers. There is several pieces that have incredible jazz elements to them, pieces that we haven't even played yet that are sitting on our desk here we're real excited to get to, having never heard them before except. Anecdotally or briefly online, you'd see another group perform them. And as Nancy said, we have not regretted it at all. And it's broadened our minds. And I now include it in the national competitions that we run for string quartets. They're required to do certain pieces of music and absolutely everybody has embraced it. No issues at all on that. So
it's been
positive.
What a wonderful effort. And speaking of the younger generation, I wanted to talk about your educational outreach as well, because that's an important part of what Artaria has done all these years. And Nancy, I'm particularly interested to hear about, people think of newer generations being less and less interested in classical music. What has been your experience as you are reaching out to younger players, engaging their interest in being involved in what you're doing and carrying on that artistic style?
Our art form is not dying. It just simply isn't. It depends, I think, where you are geographically, regionally, locally, what people are saying around you, whether the community thinks they're not interested anymore or what, but it's thriving. It is thriving all over the world. String quartet chamber music has always been a very small niche.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult. It is chamber music, especially if you're committed to one group of four people for a long time. That's a rarity, but it serves a deep purpose in people's lives. There are students who come who have kicked and screamed their way to our program by insisting with their parents they must be part of it. They want to play chamber music and they want to play in a string quartet and they want to be part of our program.
That's so great. I love it.
Oh, absolutely. There are other students who kick and scream, saying, "I don't want to do this. I don't think I'm interested in this.
That's not going to be fun.
Right? This isn't going to be any fun at all." And who are, oh my goodness, they are transformed by the experience. You get to be your best self in a string quartet. You get to say what you feel, and you are supported by three other people in your group.
If people are interested in learning more about some of the educational programs that you offer, some of them might be more conducive to people who live closer to your area, but you're involved in programs in the summer and other times that other people could attend as well. Where can they find information about what you're working on?
Actually, you can just go to the artariaquartet.com website and you'll be linked to all of these entities. We wouldn't be complete musicians without being performers and teachers. And so that's what we're doing.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad to have had this time to talk to you and learn more about that. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the next two Bartok presentations at Viterbo University Fine Arts Center Recital Hall this coming Sunday and next Sunday as well at 3 p.m. Those are ticketed performances, and you can find that information at viterbo.edu. And in the meantime, Ray Shows, Nancy Oliveros, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you for having us, Ezra.
Thanks, Ezra.
For sure. There are a couple of opportunities to hear our program every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3. Then we're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music, 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next week for another Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio.